Lecture 24, Rhetoric, A New Path to Political Power.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello again. We're now in the period known as radical democracy, the product of Effiolti's legislation of 462, as we discussed in our last lecture. It's interesting, by the way, that no one ever tries to label Effiolti's as a father of democracy. Although what he did might not be on a par with Solon or Cleisthenes, in other words, inventing the process or taking it to the masses, nevertheless, I hope you see that he's also a very important player in the democratic process. Mind you, we know a lot less about Effiolti's than we do about Solon and Cleisthenes, so perhaps that's why he's not always linked with those two. Radical democracy made the people sovereign in the state, and it brought with it a rise in the number of men who advised the people in the assembly. In this lecture, we're going to focus on how political leadership changes in the decades after Effiolti's. Specifically, we'll look at the rise in rhetoric and how it's exploited by a new group of ambitious individuals called rhetores, or speakers, as a means to political power. These men use their oratorical abilities to dominate political life in the assembly. And this was described by Aristotle as the supreme democratic body. It's important we appreciate how political power changed as it did, who these speakers were, and the importance of rhetoric, so that we can better understand Athenian democracy. And history too, for that matter, especially warfare. From now until when Macedonia abolished Athenian democracy in 322 BC. Pericles dominated political life from the death of Effiolti's in 461 to his own death in 429. He may even have engineered the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War, as I will argue in a later lecture. In Athenian history, as I said before, the 450s to the 430s are often referred to as the Periclean era or Periclean Athens. So that gives you some idea of the influence Pericles wielded. He exercised power by means of his election and re-election to the office of strategos or general. And he used this as a stepping stone into political life. He wasn't the first to use this military office as an entree into the political arena. Think of Themistocles, for example. And this sort of thing still happens today. Eisenhower and Colin Powell are two obvious recent examples. And I'm sure you could fill me in on a lot more. But now we get to the differences. Pericles was an aristocrat. So were Themistocles, Cimon, and in fact, everyone who addressed the assembly and made proposals down to the Periclean era. But when Pericles died in 429, a different type of speaker comes to influence in Athens. Not just Athens, in fact, but in many cities, many democracies throughout Greece. And in the Hellenistic period, rhetoric, which enables these speakers to come to political power, flourished in places far removed from Greece, thanks to Alexander the Great's conquests. What made these new speakers different was that they were non-nobles, and the democracy and the advances in rhetoric allowed them to rise to the heights that they did. In the assembly, anyone could speak, as Socrates, for example, tells us. Or rather, Plato has Socrates say so, because Socrates himself didn't leave anything written. We're dependent on Plato's works for all that Socrates was supposed to have said and thought. Anyway, Socrates makes the following point in Plato's Protagoras, It's a point in connection with the assembly of the late 5th century. He says, and I quote here, "When there is an issue to do with the government of the state that is to be debated, the man who gets up to advise the people may be a builder, or just as easily a blacksmith, or a shoemaker, merchant or ship owner, rich or poor, of good family or none. No one brings up against any of these men, or against those I've just mentioned, that here is a man who has no technical qualifications. He cannot say anybody was his teacher, but he tries to give advice." The big question is, how many people did speak? How many of the mass of people attending an assembly actually availed themselves of the system and spoke? Even today, not everyone can stand up and speak in front of an audience, whether it's a classroom of 50 students, a wedding reception of 100 guests, but especially not, I would think, in front of several thousand people. And that number would be the average that attended assemblies. Many men probably did stand up to speak in an assembly, and then their legs went wobbly, suddenly not knowing what to say, or losing that burst of self-confidence when the time to speak actually came, or being tired. Assemblies normally started about dawn and lasted until the late afternoon. People took their lunches with them. They took a cushion to sit on because the Pinnacles was just a lump of rock. So this stretched on for the entire day. It would get tiring. Also, some people might not simply have had the voice that would carry a long distance. Let's not forget that the assembly met on top of the Pinnacles in the open air. There was no modern public address system. And the further one sat back from the speaker's rostrum, the harder it would be to hear, especially as the assembly goers didn't sit silent, but talked among themselves and at times raised quite a din. Thucydides will tell us this, that the assembly goers often join in on debates, cheering and jeering. It's been estimated that only 1/5 of the audience might have been able to hear at most 85% of what was said. That means 4/5 didn't hear hardly anything. I'm reminded of that scene, that very funny scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian, in which we have the Sermon on the Mount, with Christ allegedly addressing the people with delivering the Sermon on the Mount. And as he speaks, the camera pans back over the assembled throng, and it pulls back to the very rear of the people gathered there. And they can't hear what he's saying, and they mistake what he's saying. There's that line where he's supposed to have said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." By the time that gets to the rear of the crowd, somebody thinks that he said, "Blessed are the cheesemakers." And someone next to that person says, no, he doesn't mean cheesemakers, he means all manufacturers of dairy produce. Now, this is very funny, but it's the sort of thing that must have happened. And it's one thing to have this sort of humorous exchange in a movie, The Life of Brian, but it's quite another when we think about an assembly meeting that debated state policy. All matters of domestic and foreign policy came before it. The people voted yes or no. And only 20% or so could hear what was going on. But what probably stopped most people from speaking was their inability to do so in a compelling manner. That's why the aristocrats probably dominated assemblies for as long as they did. First, people expected them to speak. Just like today, we turn to leaders for comment or words of comfort in times of disaster, for example. And second, the aristocrats were probably used to speaking. They did it all the time. But non-nobles didn't speak all the time. Yet as non-nobles began to get wealthier as time wore on, as the Delian League turned into an Athenian empire, and more importantly, advances in rhetoric meshed with the radical democracy of Ephialtes, we have then a time that would favour all men to try their hand at speaking, because rhetoric gave them the means to learn how to speak and to speak persuasively. Now, there was rhetoric before democracy, of course, just as there was public speaking. You can find it in the Homeric poems. But even in the 5th century, rhetorical theory as such was still in its infancy. But as Thucydides tells us, it was the visit to Athens of Gorgias from the town of Leontini in Sicily in the year 427 that affected the Athenians more than anything else. Gorgias appeared before the assembly asking the people for help against Syracuse. And the Athenians were apparently so mesmerized by his performance that they gave him that help. Now, here we are in the 4th year or so of the Peloponnesian War. The Athenians are recovering from a crippling plague, all of which we'll come on to in due course. The last thing they ought to have been doing was agreeing to give a representative from the town of Leontini in Sicily assistance against Syracuse, the most powerful polis on Sicily. But they were won over by Gorgias' oratorical prowess. Later, Gorgias would return to Athens, and he taught rhetoric there and elsewhere in Greece, for a fee, of course. What Gorgias taught was the means for anyone, no matter how inexpert he was, to speak on any subject and persuade the listeners he was right. That for Gorgias was the most important thing. Not morality, not taking part in political life because one genuinely wants to make a difference. For Gorgias, the most important thing was being able to use words to persuade an audience either in a political gathering or in a law court. To Gorgias, arguments based on the probability carried more weight than the truth. Now, this argument based on probability, the Greek word is eikota, and sometimes we see it written as to eikos, the probable. What that means is that you are constructing a case based on someone probably doing the thing, and therefore he's guilty. In a court of law, for example, you might say to the jurors, gentlemen of the jury, the defendant has stolen sheep before, so he's probably stolen the sheep now. That's why he's on trial. No wonder Plato condemned Gorgias and the whole theory of probability, because it had nothing to do with the facts. Of course, people lapped this up. This is the sort of thing that would be akin to a modern get-rich scheme. Just about. At the same time, rhetoric was a seriously intellectual study. Before long, rhetoric had become an integral part of education. Aristotle would call it a techne, an art form. And rhetoric becomes a fundamental basis, if you like, to the Roman system of education, just as it does down to today. Look at the number of departments or programs in rhetoric or communication in any university. It all hails back to the Greeks. But as well as an intellectual area of study, rhetoric, or rather its practical application, oratory, was the key to influence in a state. Now, this is true not just in the political arena of the assembly or the boule, but also the judicial arena, the law courts, as we'll see. Because rhetoric and your oratorical prowess meant that you could sway people from individuals to a large gathering of people, as in the assembly, that came to be seen as the key to success. Now, not all speakers would be able to take advantage of a rhetorical training. Or Perhaps they didn't even need it. Some men would have been savvy enough to see how things were done, to see how things were said, just by attending assembly meetings. But rhetoric didn't just bring about the end of public speaking as the preserve of the aristocrats, because non-nobles weren't merely speaking in debates, but were advising on policy and then proposing it. So, as the radical democracy continued over the years, it became obvious that the road to political power no longer lay in holding an elected political office, an elected office like, say, the archonship. No, the road to political power now lay in addressing assemblies, being persuasive, and as a result, building up a following. Solon's system had been for the non-nobles to acquire the necessary wealth to work their way into those top two property groups, the Pentecostia Medimnoi and the Hippes, and then as a result stand for the archonship. Solon had always seen the Areopagus and the Archons ruling in tandem. Now the switch from the direct election of Archons to their selection by lot in 487 may have played some role in the decreasing attraction of the archonships. But rhetoric was the nail in the coffin. Why bother standing for an office when you don't need to anymore, when you can stand up in front of the people in the assembly and, touch wood, persuade them to follow you? Solon's system was to all intents and purposes now obsolete. Ambitious men saw that the path to power lay in building this following in the assembly by persuading the masses to follow what they were saying. At the same time, it also gave these ambitious individuals the chance to move upward socially in society, to be on some par, if you like, with their aristocratic peers, even if they were never, by birth, part of that same social grouping. That's why they may have wanted to exploit rhetoric as a means to the end of gaining power, not necessarily, though, to do well for the city. There is a difference between gaining power for your own aims and then gaining power because you want to do well for the city. Now, these new speakers, that's these new non-nobles who appear in the assembly using rhetoric as a basis for building a following, these new speakers are given the collective name rhetores, or orators, because they use their oratorical ability to sway the audience to their side. And as a group over the decades, they had similar characteristics. And you see in rhetores, we get our word rhetoric. Just as the archaic age tyrants had had things in common, so the rhetores as a group had things in common. For example, they were all non-nobles. Hence, they didn't have the support network and family ties that the aristocrats had. Now, we'll be meeting one of these new men down the track during the Peloponnesian War, who was not a non-noble, he was an aristocrat. This is someone called Alcibiades. But he's kind of the exception to the rule, because Thucydides thinks he's a demagogue. Thucydides lumps him in with these rhetores because he believes that Alcibiades is venal. For the most part, then, these rhetores are non-nobles. They had not held any military office, unlike Pericles, but remember he was an aristocrat. They had become wealthy through business and trade. And so they were the nouveau riche element of society that had decided that they too had the right to speak at assemblies. And so they began to do so. Now, needless to say, the aristocratic stratum of society was completely against people who they considered came from the wrong side of the tracks and shouldn't meddle in affairs that didn't concern them. Indeed, The Athenian upper class looked down its nose at anyone who was involved in manual labour of any description. So it didn't really matter how rich you were always going to come from the wrong side of the tracks. It's hard to communicate this very European attitude here in America, where money is king. But folks like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett would have been scorned by the classical Athenians. Perhaps a better analogy is to think of the British House of Lords and the difference between the hereditary peerages of the nobility. We have a family like the Percys, one of the most aristocratic in England. It goes back to the days of Henry VIII. And then we have the peerages bestowed in more recent time on non-nobles, such as Andrew Lloyd Webber. Pots of money or not, Lord Webber will never be seen as really part of the aristocracy, and everyone knows that. The social snobbery on the part of this upper stratum of society, on the part of the aristocrats, led to other terms being applied to the rhetores. And these other terms eventually took on odious connotations. And the most common term was demagogue, the Greek word demagogos. Now, this word means literally leader of the people. But it doesn't follow that the person leading the people is doing so in a proper manner, leading them down the garden path more likely for a hidden agenda to achieve political power. The first, or the prototype demagogue we shall meet in our course, was an Athenian called Cleon. He would dominate political life in the early years of the Peloponnesian War. His father owned a tannery, a factory that turned hides into leather, and Cleon was worth quite a bit of money. Not that that mattered, because he was not old money. He wasn't an aristocrat. Now, I don't actually think Cleon had a rhetorical education to call it that, because Gorgias came to Athens in 427, and by that time Cleon was already politically active. In fact, he'd been a member of the Boule the previous year. I suspect Cleon was one of those naturally talented people who could do a job once he saw how it was done. In his case, probably from attending assemblies, he saw how speakers persuaded people. And with his natural skill at public speaking, he was able to do the same thing fairly easily. He had quite a different style from his predecessor, Pericles, whose death in 429 opened the door to the non-noble demagogues. And the difference in style is that Cleon would berate the people in the assembly and criticize them. He would get in their faces. And this criticism of his audience set a trend that other rhetores followed. And perhaps it was deliberate. Perhaps it was deliberate to emphasize the difference between the old aristocratic speakers and the new men. As different, for example, as between rock and roll and punk. It's a whole new movement. This trend, as I said, didn't abate. It remains a constant throughout the 5th and 4th centuries. Let me jump ahead to this time, to the 4th century, to illustrate its longevity. Perhaps the most famous demagogue was Demosthenes, who lived and worked during the later 4th century. He was the one who led Athenian opposition to Philip II of Macedonia. Now, I'm going to be mentioning Demosthenes in the next lecture as well, so we may as well meet him now. Demosthenes began a career writing speeches for others to give in the law courts. And eventually, he entered the political arena of the assembly in the 350s. By the middle of the 340s, he was so powerful in Athens that the people blindly followed his anti-Macedonian policy. And it was that policy that led to the Greek defeat at the Battle of Chaeronea in Boeotia in 338 and the end of Greek autonomy. With Demosthenes, the question is whether he was Greece's greatest patriot, as is sometimes touted, a man who stood firm against the oppression of Philip at all costs. Hence, his policy failure was a noble one. Or was he someone who cynically exploited the threat from Philip as a platform to political power, the hidden agenda? However, Demosthenes, although he held some official offices, was never archon. His power base came from his speaking in the assembly. And yet in the 340s, Demosthenes' policy was that of Athens. His power was that great. Now, to be fair, many of the demagogues were not venal. Many of them didn't pursue their own agendas, even if they're presented like that by the sources. In addition to the social snobbery directed against the demagogues, many ancient writers have personal axes to grind against them. Cleon gets an abysmal press in Thucydides and Aristophanes. According to Thucydides, Cleon prolonged the Peloponnesian War so that his own corrupt activities would never become public. He ripped off the people, he ripped off Athens, and even when he died in battle against Sparta, Thucydides cannot say anything good about him. In reality, Cleon does a good job, as we'll see in our discussion of the Peloponnesian War. And Cleon doing a good job is going to be a major heresy on my part, so stay tuned for that one. Thucydides hates Cleon because Cleon probably arranged for Thucydides to be exiled in 424 BC. A century later, the Athenian constitution also rips into Cleon for his lack of decorum on the rostrum as he addressed the people in the assembly, unlike everyone else who spoke properly and civilly. Remember my interpretation of the phrase Golden Age as it applied to Pisistratus? I said that the Athenian constitution called Pisistratus' tyranny that because Pisistratus muzzled the growing political power of the people. He introduced measures like travelling deem justices and loans to farmers to keep the people on their lands, not milling around in the city. The Athenian constitution was written when it's those same people are able to exploit rhetoric to gain political ascendancy over the people. We need to bear in mind that the bad press the demagogues get is hardly fair and that it's because of the snobbery that existed. Some demagogues were corrupt, but others weren't. And we shouldn't forget that those who claw their way to the top, like the Cleons of the world, often do a better job than those who can exploit family connections. Think about us today. We can see then the dangers in classical Athens from the rhetoric of clever speakers, especially as the people who are debating on policy and then voting on it are largely non-experts. In fact, most of them can't even hear what's going on. Today, we might be better at evaluating the policies of political leaders. We might be better at evaluating them more critically, that is. Not least because we're better informed, because we have ease of access to all sorts of information, especially online. The sorts of things that the classical Athenians clearly didn't have. But that doesn't stop us being misled or presented with information that we're told is legitimate and was vetted by intelligence agencies in various countries. Think about the use of scare tactic rhetoric that was peddled to the public over the threat of WMD being manufactured in Iraq. Nothing much changes then. Perhaps we shouldn't chuck every politician in the venal or hidden agenda box, or dismiss every single thing we hear as a lie, or at the least an embellishment. But are our expectations different from those of the Athenians? If we can recognize that leaders falsify the truth, and I'll return to this point in our next lecture, were the Athenians any different? Were they in the dark about rhetorical tricks as we might not be? The impression we get is that people in the assembly were putty in the hands of clever speakers. They exploited all sorts of rhetorical tricks to make their cases. And so we see the fundamental flaw in the direct democracy. It's hardly surprising then that the people made disastrous choices when they were swayed more by emotion than reason, swayed more by the act of someone speaking than the content. But it's clear that the people back then were aware of the exploitation of rhetoric for political purposes. I mean, everyone knew what rhetoric was about because it was taught in schools. But they were also warned about it and its pitfalls by the very people making speeches. For example, in 427, the Athenians were debating what to do with the people of Mytilene on the island of Lesbos after they'd revolted from the Athenian Empire. We'll come on to this in a later lecture. Thucydides gives us a version of the debate in the assembly about this punishment, during which Cleon spoke, and he criticised the people for how they were speech-goers, as he calls them, and how they enjoyed a good speech for its performance rather than its content. And in a play like Euripides' Hippolytus that was performed in 428, Hippolytus says that speakers who look like fools before wise men are seen as eloquent by the crowd. The Athenian system of democracy strikes us as odd when the people seem to expect to be beguiled by the rhetoric of their speakers. But what are the implications of the relationship of the speaker to the mass of the people in the radical democracy? Does it affect the sovereignty of the people in reality? And if our own democracy owes so much to that of the Greeks, how different is it? Finally, how is rhetoric used by modern politicians and leaders? In other words, what is the rhetorical debt that today's leaders or speechwriters owe to the Greeks? These questions we're going to address in our next lecture. Thank you very much.